So, what's on your mind?
Well, what's on my mind right now is this book is about to come out or is just coming out, and so I'm frantically trying to remember what I put in it.
You did a lot of researching about brain science for this book, and you went through the whole process of writing. And after learning all this and then processing all of it, do you think you see the world any differently?
I do. I see the world differently, and I see my own head differently. One of the things that happens going through this kind of process where you're investigating this world and talking to so many experts and also doing these experiments that I kind of did on my own brain, you go through a period where you're very self-aware, and lots of different kind of components of the brain's internal architecture become kind of visible to you in a new way. You hear them kind of differently. But then you get kind of past that, and you just have a very, I think, more nuanced kind of sense of what's going on in your brain. And you start to recognize kind of patterns of behavior, patterns of kind of emotional reaction to things that you were aware of in a kind of background way, but they have a new kind of intensity to them. I think it's quite similar to what people, I've never really gone through this before, but what people say about practices like meditation. When you spend a lot of time being in a very quiet space, kind of listening to yourself think, you start to develop kind of an awareness of these things. And I think you can get some of the same kind of discrimination from learning about how the brain works. You start to hear it. And one of the metaphors I have in the book is that you hear it less as a kind of a symphony, a wash of sound, and more like a series of kind of individual instruments.
So give me an example of one way, I guess, that you've looked at the world differently now.
Well, there's an opening chapter called Mind Sight where I talk about this property that's sometimes called mind reading, which is our extraordinary ability to detect subtle changes in emotional expression, in speech intonation, in facial expressions, second by second changes in tone and kind of emotional color that we are, as a species, incredibly good at. We're so good at it that we don't even realize how good we are at it. People, we believe, who have difficulty with these things are autistic people who are kind of challenged in their ability to kind of read the subtleties of facial expressions, and that accounts for a lot of their social disconnection that you experience around somebody who's autistic. Most of us are not autistic. Most of us have this extraordinary skill of being able to kind of read other people's minds through these tiny little micro expressions. But those talents lie on a scale, basically. There are some people who are very good at this kind of stuff, and there are some people who are less good at it. Some people are a little closer on the scale. There's actually something called AQ or autism quotient, that's kind of a parallel to IQ and intelligence quotient. And so as I've learned more about that and taken some tests to kind of identify my own particular skills to this, I've started dividing the world up into people who are particularly good mind readers and people who are not particularly good mind readers. And I've suddenly explained a lot of things to me about people that I suddenly thought, that's why my conversations with that person have been so good. That's why I always feel kind of locked in when I talk to them. And then that's why that person always tells jokes that fall a little flat, where he kind of misanticipates the attention of the room when he's sitting at the dinner table party. So it kind of ex it brings into kind of new relief properties in other people's brains and in your own brains, that you really couldn't see before.
So has that actually, I guess, affected the way that you interact with other people?
Well, I tend to be a little bit more conscious of situations in which my mind reading skills are not working very well. I can sometimes recognize that I'm being a little sloppy or I'm not doing a particularly good job. And also, I find myself when I'm talking to somebody who I sense is not particularly astute in terms of reading my expressions, I find myself subtly exaggerating them so that they'll get the message, basically. It's a little bit like you become this kind of cartoon character version of yourself, where you've kind of heightened your expressions so that they'll get the code.
In this book, you write a lot about different fears that you have, and you talk a lot about the neuroscience behind fear. How did, I guess, learning about that and then thinking about the way it works in your own brain, how did that help you either deal or cope with the fears that you have?
Well, I've been a fearful person for most of my life, so it was great to kind of learn a little bit more about this. There was this story I tell in the book where a window blew in, practically hitting my wife in our apartment that we used to live in the West Village. It was a very kind of traumatic experience. It was quite a bit like a car accident experience what people will have. And I went through, you know, a long period kind of thinking about it. And to this day, I can't hear the sound of wind kind of whistling through a window without getting this kind of fear response in me. Now, I know from my research in the book a lot about what that fear response is. It's activating a part of the brain called the amygdala, which is central to a lot of emotional processing, but particularly to fear. The other important thing about it is that memories that have been marked as traumatic ones, memories in which the fear response kind of kicked in, are stored separately from memories that are just kind of day-to-day lives. And that's one of the reasons why they're so persistent. It's because they have their own kind of separate place, and they can become, in a sense, kind of detached from your traditional memories of the event. And to some extent, what's happened to me now when I think about this in the context, if I hear wind whistling through a window and I'm reminded of this window blowing in, I can't make the feeling go away. I can't stop the feeling of kind of adrenaline coursing through my body and myself getting excited and slightly on edge. But because I know the story behind that feeling, because I'm able to kind of contextualize it, it's less debilitating. You don't feel the sense of your body being kind of held hostage anymore. You're able to say, okay, look, my body has just released a drug because it's organized this way. My brain is organized this way to respond to a certain type of event. And I'm going to be under the influences of that drug for the next 5 minutes or so, and then it'll go away. And knowing all of that makes the whole experience just kind of easier to live through.
It's sort of like you and your amygdala have come to some sort of agreement.
We're getting along much better now. The other, you know, fascinating part about all this is that there's something called flashbulb memory that happens when traumatic events happen, where your brain basically captures lots of stray details that are happening, kind of visual stimuli sound or tactile stimuli coming in, the moment something traumatic, fearful is happening. And I noticed this with 9/11, where we were living down in the West Village, and we had a 3-day-old boy in our house on the morning of 9/11. And I found in the weeks and months that followed that day that I noticed that I was a little bit more on edge on days that had the same weather as 9/11, i.e. very clear days with big blue skies, no clouds around. And for a long time, I thought this was just a silly kind of associative memory that wasn't particularly relevant. But then I thought about it, and I thought about the nature of the attacks on that day. And I thought, you know, if my brain were simply just trying to protect me from an exact duplication of the original 9/11 attacks, then there is more reason to be worried on clear days than on cloudy days. Because if you're trying to fly by visual flight rules into a building, it's easier to do that on a clear day than it is on a cloudy day. And so my brain had picked up some kind of stray detail from that environment and remembered it and was reminding me of that connection without me fully making the connection myself in a conscious way. And that was one of those situations where I was irritated that I was feeling on edge because the weather was nice, but I also found it strangely comforting that my brain was kind of looking out for me in this way as well.
In the book, you talk about going up to Columbia and having your brain scanned. And you have your brain scanned while you're sort of thinking about writing. So did that process, I guess, shed any light on the way that you write and the way that you basically do what you do?
Yeah, I did. This is kind of the end of the book. I went up and did an fMRI, which is kind of the state of the art in brain imaging. It's a terrifying process where you have to stick your head in this giant kind of magnet. And I had a wonderful collaborator up there, Joy Hirsch, who helped me design this experiment. And basically, I wanted to see if I could capture my brain kind of coming up with a new idea as it was being scanned by the state of the art of the technology. And what we ended up doing was basically constructing this kind of test where I would look at various passages of text, and including some of my own from the book that I was in the middle of writing. This became very self-referential. And hopefully an idea would occur to me while I had my head in this crazy scanner. And in fact, what happened during the segment where I was supposed to come up with an idea, we did it twice. And the first time I panicked, as you might imagine. I, you know, was in this very uncomfortable physical environment, and the clock started ticking for me to come up with an idea. And what went on in my head was, come up with an idea, come up with an idea, come up with an idea. And it was completely useless for the 30 seconds they were watching. But the second time, I decided to do something which I'd already been kind of instinctively doing, which was to start thinking about how I was going to describe the scene that I was experiencing in the book. And so I, when the clock started ticking for the second go through, I started kind of writing a couple of sentences in my head, and managed to write and hold in my head a couple of sentences that showed up in the book, you know, 2 days later when I sat down and wrote them out on the computer. When we went back and looked at the images of these two different scans, the difference was absolutely striking. In the first one, when I'm flailing around, there's activity all over my brain, actually. There's lots of activity in lots of different places, both in areas showing eye movement and areas showing visual processing and areas associated with language, and then just a general noise. It's not a particularly structured image. In the image where I'm actually focusing and when I'm actually, you know, composing a sentence, there's almost no activity whatsoever. There's just a tiny bit of activity in the language areas. There's almost no activity in the visual centers, even though my eyes are open and I'm looking at text. And there's area and there's activity in the kind of in a kind of a master area that controls activity in the rest of the brain. And everything else is basically kind of dark in this image. And so it shows you really that some of your best moments are not about your brain kind of going into overdrive. It's about your brain shutting things down. When you're focused, you're often not having a lot of activity in lots of parts of your brain. You're actually having very focused activity in very small parts of your brain. So the old slogan about, you know, you only use 10% of your brain has it actually exactly the wrong way around. It's a good thing that you only use 10% of your brain. If you used 100% of your brain, it would be noise.
So as a writer, when you actually sit down to, you know, write a passage in a book or an article or anything like that, I mean, this insight now that you have into how your brain works when you write, does that affect the way you go about the writing process?
One of the things that I did with this book, actually, that was partially influenced by the subject matter of this book, which was I wrote it each chapter straight through. Each day I would sit down and write, you know, 500 to 1,000 words. And then pick it up the next day and not reread the whole chapter to get to wherever I'd gotten. I just would sit down, remember where I was, and start writing. And I did this because I was becoming aware of how much wear and tear you get from kind of the memories of reading text over and over again. You get to a point where basically you can't hear the text anymore. You basically, it all seems kind of inert to you. And you get to that point pretty much with your own stuff after you've read it 5 or 6 times. It just, you can't hear whether it's good or not. All the ideas seem very obvious. All the language seems kind of very flat. And so what I tried to do was to preserve the number of times that I would read it, to keep it as short as possible, precisely so that my kind of memory systems wouldn't take the color out of the text. And hopefully it gave it a kind of a fresher, kind of more lively kind of feel. And I was able to survive the process of going through edits as well without it getting as bored as you normally get when you go through, you know, reading your book 10 times.
So you have 2 small children, and, you know, children are such a sort of a wonderful window into the brain and seeing, you know, how we think about things, especially, you know, in our early stages. Knowing what you now know about brain science and all that you've learned and all that, does it change the way you kind of view their actions?
Well, it does. I mean, my wife joked with me when I started this project and we were starting the project of having our first boy. She said, no experiments on the boys. And so I was limited in what I was able to do, unfortunately. But you really become, one of the things that's come out of the research is how closely related the natural chemistry of bonding and of love and of parental affiliation is to the unnatural chemistry of recreational drugs, particularly opiates. And, you know, love really is a kind of a drug. The natural opiates are involved in a drug called oxytocin, which is very important in creating kind of bonding between partners and between parent and child. Part of the experience for me has been the wonder of feeling certain ways towards your children, having a kind of a feeling in your body that you've literally never kind of had before, and being able to say, oh, this is this chemical that's being released in a certain kind of configuration that I've never experienced before. And there are some people who would say that knowing that kind of takes the wonder out of the experience, but for me, it only kind of amplifies it. I still feel the emotion very powerfully, but I also feel some wonder at the whole system that evolved in my brain to let me feel that emotion. It also, frankly, makes you feel a newfound sympathy for people who've had to deal with drug addiction. So we understand entirely why somebody would throw away their life for their child. But we find it hard to understand why somebody would throw away their life for just a drug. But in fact, the feeling, the power, the intensity of attachment that you have to a drug is quite similar to the feeling that you have to a child, because it relies, in a sense, on the same chemistry. So it shed light both on the power of parenting, but also the power of addiction as well.
You were mentioning before about how some people, when you sort of tell them about how some of this works, the neuroscience behind certain feelings, especially ones like love and creativity, yeah. It's people kind of frown on that a little bit, because it's like, oh, you know, you're taking the mystery out of it. I don't want to really know how that works. I want it to be magical. Do you think there's a problem in maybe trying to think a little bit too much about this, or overanalyzing sort of the processes that are going on in the background, you know, to the point that we're, I guess, thinking ourselves out of whatever we're doing?
Mm-hmm. One of the experiences that I've noticed thus far from people reading the book is that if one person in a marriage or a couple reads the book and the other doesn't, it seems to create some weird tension where the one who hasn't read the book yet starts saying things like, are you getting this from Steven Johnson's book? So, you know, anybody who's reading it and their partner isn't, you know, I encourage you to buy two copies. I think, as I said, you know, I think that there's a bit of a, when you're in the middle of the ideas, there is a tendency to kind of get lost in kind of introspection and be thinking about your amygdala when you should be thinking about the immediate threat that's in front of you. But I in general feel like we're going to be walking around with a working theory about how our brain operates, whether it's Freudian, whether it's some kind of spiritual tradition, whether it's kind of pop psychology. So if we're going to have some kind of model in our heads for why we do things, you know, oh, I repressed that thought. Well, that's a kind of a Freudian idea. Whatever language we're going to use, some kind of language. And so I feel like this at least should be on the table. There's so much knowledge that's come out. Brain science has advanced so much in the last 20 years, partially because of these imaging technologies, partially because there's a newfound interest in emotion, which was just totally ignored until the 70s, really. And so it's become a much more sophisticated model. And I think, you know, with the right level of kind of popularization, it can be usefully applied to your own life. And if you're going to have a model, I think this is as good as any.
You talk about biofeedback in the book, and then also just this whole idea of, you know, sort of understanding what's going on and the way that this, you know, helps you sort of get a grip on your life. And you know, what do you think there might be some sort of future applications if we kind of take this kind of knowledge and extend it beyond where it's at now?
Well, there have been some interesting ones that are just starting to come out using bio and neurofeedback, which are basically sensors hooked up to your body, checking your heart rate or your brain waves being emitted from your you know, the surface of your skull, which is amazing that they can do this. And a couple of them have actually involved video games. I mean, there's one that just came out called Journey to the Wild Divine, I believe it's called. And it's using biofeedback sensors that are looking at your heart rate and a few other things. And you play the game literally by chilling out. You advance to different levels and pass various kinds of tests in the game, not by manipulating a joystick, but by getting yourself to a very calm, relaxed state. And if you get to a particularly calm, relaxed state, you can get to the next level in the game. So it's, you know, in a sense, it's exactly the opposite of, you know, Quake or Grand Theft Auto, the games that are about, you know, shooting people and blowing things up and all about adrenaline. This is a game about lowering your adrenaline levels. It's a fascinating experiment. It's an interesting game, partially because you cannot play it while drinking a cup of coffee. I've tried it, and you just can't get anything done because the coffee's making you too hyped up.
It's sort of like a tech-informed kind of meditation.
Yeah, no, it is. And I think they're using some of these technologies, neurofeedback in particular, and I talk about this in the book, to treat kids with ADD and ADHD. But there is also a kind of a subculture of meditation enthusiasts, because there are a couple of states, brainwave states, that are associated with deep meditation. there are people who see this as a way of getting to those states faster, because you're getting feedback about what your brain is actually doing. And you can see if you change your brain, your kind of mental state a certain way, you can see that result on the screen or sometimes in the form of audio. And it just helps you kind of drive your brain into kind of these states more clearly. For me, what I got out of it was less reaching some new kind of state of transcendence, but more just a more, again, nuanced awareness of the different modes of attention that I have. And there are some, when I'm writing, for instance, there's a certain kind of attention where, I mean, you know, 747 could be taken off in the next room and I wouldn't even hear it because I'm just kind of in this space on the screen typing away. I wrote a lot of this book with a, you know, year-old boy running, screaming around the house in our old place where I didn't even have an office. And I thought I was going to have trouble with it, but I realized that if I'm writing, I can do, basically, I'm focused in a way that I can deal with all that kind of external stimuli. But there are other states where I'm focused, but in a slightly different kind of version. When I'm talking to people who are kind of strangers or new acquaintances, I have a very kind of electrified state. I mean, if you're kind of almost a little too kind of amped up, I find sometimes. And it's something, again, that I'd experienced my whole life, but until I started reading about the technology, reading about the science of attention and focus, I wasn't able to kind of break off these different kind of categories of attention into real categories. They were just this kind of general lump thing of being focused or not focused, which is not nearly precise enough.
So in almost every question that I've asked you today, you've made a joke. So what's going on when that happens?
Well, the reason I wrote this book, the thing that started me on this book was I was trying a biofeedback kind of test years ago, and it was basically regulating my or monitoring my adrenaline levels, and I could see on a screen where my adrenaline levels were. And for the first 3-4 minutes of this kind of conversation with this biofeedback practitioner, my adrenaline levels were very kind of calm and flat. And the guy actually complimented me on having a very well-regulated adrenal system.
You must have been very proud.
I was very proud. I put that on a plaque somewhere. And then in the course of having this conversation, I made a joke. And all of a sudden, there was this huge spike on the screen. And we both kind of looked over and like, whoa, what was that? And at the end of the session, basically, he gave me a printout of this kind of graph, and it was, for all intents and purposes, a chart of my attempts at humor over the preceding 30 minutes. There's 6 spikes in the middle of this flat line. And it was this kind of moment of insight where I thought, all my life, I've been making these jokes kind of compulsively in situations, sometimes inappropriately in situations where really it was too serious for a joke or too formal. And I thought, I've been doing this all this time to get these little adrenaline spikes. Or perhaps the adrenaline spikes are me kind of revving up to deliver the joke. I'm still not quite sure which it is. But somehow there was this kind of, basically this kind of drug release going on in my head every time I made a joke. And I thought to myself, gosh, you know, I thought I was just kind of a funny guy, but actually I'm kind of a drug addict. You know, I'm addicted to these feelings, this kind of chemical release in my head. And I thought, here I just, in 30 minutes, got this fascinating new glimpse into some little sub part of my personality seen from a completely new way. And what else is going on in there? What else would I find if I kind of explored my own head with the same sets of tools or to related tools? And that's what really started me on the journey.
Is there anything else you think I need to know?
If you do go try an fMRI, having been inspired by the book, be prepared to freak out. It is a very scary experience. I'm not at all claustrophobic. I have a long list of fears, some of which are itemized in the book, but I was startled at how unnerved I was by it. It's not. I thought it was going to be quite fun because of the whole experience, and I actually thought about 10 minutes into it that I was going to have to be taken out because it was just too noisy and can find a space. But besides that, all the other things I try in the book, everybody else should give a shot at.